Welcome to Science Fiction 101, the podcast series where we look at the science fiction field from all angles, past, present, and future. I'm Phil.
And I'm Colin.
And we're recording this on the 18th of August, 2023, although on my script it says 18th of July, 2023, which is not true at all, but, you know, wibbly-wobbly, timey-wimey. And we're going to be exploring Doctor Who today, the British TV series, which is a grand old 60 years old this year. So it's something that's been there either in the foreground or the background of every British child for a couple of generations now, and still going strong. So we'll talk about Doctor Who, and we'll have our usual roundup of recommendations of past, present, and future science fiction. Now, Colin, do you remember what we talked about last episode?
No, apparently.
we read a couple of books.
That's right.
That was Little Fuzzy.
Yeah, it was a Fuzzy Cast.
That's right, yes. Fuzzy Logic, I think I called it. And we had some feedback on that episode. I'd mentioned in passing in the episode that I thought John Scalzi's Fuzzy Nation was the only instance I could think of where one author rewrote a book by another, without recasting it into a different setting or anything like that. Mm-hmm. Now, Andy replied to this, and he said, "I thought loads of books and films are reworkings of Shakespeare. I'm not well versed in Shakespeare, but I imagine someone will pop up and list all the sci-fi books that are reworkings of Othello or Much Ado About Nothing. But then again, those were plays, not novels." So Andy has rebutted his own point there. I was talking about people who'd taken a novel and rewritten it as another novel. And yeah, so there are examples of adaptation, one form to another, but very few where novels are turned into novels. But then Andy found a link to a news story about an American author who had essentially rewritten David Copperfield. So that may be a new example, a new instance of this phenomenon. Andy did also read Little Fuzzy, prompted by the podcast, and he found the ending a bit weird. He said, "How can you say they are sentient or sapient, but still treat them as pets? It was a little odd, and I thought a little disrespectful of their newly found status in the universe." And that was something I felt as well, that Little Fuzzy declared the creatures sapient, but then still talked about them as pets. It's a bit bizarre. We also heard from Bay, who said, "I enjoyed rereading the original just recently. I'd read it as a kid. Interesting to listen to the comparison, and I may read the Scalzi at some point. It struck me that the whole context of corporate power equals extraction and abuse feels different today, maybe, than in the 1960s, when we didn't automatically think all corporations were evil, whereas I think a lot of folks do think so now. So the storyline feels more predictable today," which I think is a fair observation.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. And then we heard from Emmanuel, who said quite succinctly, "As a rather fuzzy man myself, I can relate to the plight of these poor creatures. Thank you for honouring them so." So thank you, Emmanuel. I don't know whether he's physically fuzzy or whether he's a bit lightheaded. I'm not really clear. But
based on his icon on Twitter and other places, I would say he's probably a man of prodigious facial hair.
Probably so. And then man legend Malk, and I'm sure that's his real name, said, "Like the Old Man War Saga, and I did like Fuzzy Nation, but a lot of Scalzi's work I find off-putting, as I struggle to get over 'he said, she said' after every single line of dialogue. I know it's daft, but it doesn't half bug me." So I'm absolutely with you, man legend Malk, because I listened to the audiobook of Fuzzy Nation, which is beautifully read by Will Wheaton. But he diligently reads out every single one of those "he saids, she saids." And Scalzi never varies it. He never says "he muttered" or "he whispered" or "he screamed" or "she shouted." No, it's always "he said" and "she said." And it's very repetitive. Don't know why he does it. I think he's just trying to boost the word count or something. Anyway. At some point, Colin, we sort of idly wondered whether the book had been reviewed, Little Fuzzy, whether it had been reviewed at the time, back in 1962. And I found some reviews.
You did?
I did. There was one in Analog in July 1960, which is by their book reviewer P. Schuyler Miller. And he wrote in part, it's a few paragraphs, but he says, "The fuzzies are peeping fuzzballs that make tools, enjoy TV, and become more enchanting company the more you see of them." And then he says, "Enroll me among the friends of Little Fuzzy. It's the best book H. Beam Piper has ever done, and for my money, the best out in the first third of 1962. So that little end bit of sentence is quite significant, because we're talking about somebody who reviews books constantly for one of the leading science fiction magazines of the day. Mm-hmm. And he's saying it's one of the best books from the first third of 1962. Now, obviously, there's two more thirds to that year, and maybe some masterpieces came out. But I think that's significant. That shows us that the book did have some positive reaction at the time. And the other two reviews I found, one was in a British magazine called Science Fantasy, which is a very brief little capsule review. It says, "Listed as science fiction, but really more of the wacky offbeat variety. Mr. Piper, being a competent top rank author, gets away with a plot most authors would fall down on." So, yes, not so well liked there. That was written by Ted Carnell, who was the editor of Science Fantasy. And then Invector, which is the British Science Fiction Association journal, none other than Brian Aldiss, the famed science fiction novelist and historian, he wrote a review, which was a bit a review which is a bit mixed. And his summing up is, "All in all, this is not the sort of SF novel I would want to fall into the hands of non-fans, just because they were attracted by the big-eyed monster on the cover. SF fans will probably dissect the book to their own satisfaction." So, although he found some things of value in the book, he felt that it would appeal to the general reader because it had these fuzzy little creatures on the cover. And anyone who is not from the science fiction field who would pick that up would then get a distorted sense of what science fiction was. I think that's a perennial problem for science fiction books that try to break through to the mainstream. But so some mixed reviews there, and I think it's fair to say from those three limited reviews, a better received book in the US than in Britain. But then I think British reviewers often tend to be a bit snarky and sarcastic.
Unlike the podcasters.
I was going to say self-included.
Oh, dear.
So if you would like to join in the conversation, you can post comments on our blog at 101sf.blogspot.com or find us on Facebook as Science Fiction 101 Podcast. On to Doctor who is, well, he's not 60 years old, but the TV show is 60 years old this year. And I'm just going to put a little asterisk in the air there, because I implied there that Doctor Who is the name of the character. I'll come back to that later. The TV show is 60 years old, so we thought we ought to do something about the old Time Lord. So, what are we going to do, Colin?
I think we should watch one of the original episodes from 1963, mm-hmm. and then we should watch one of the best newer episodes, say from 2009.
What a great idea. By coincidence, that's what we've done.
Excellent.
We've watched those two. So we're actually going to do this in two episodes. This time we'll cover the very first Doctor Who, and then next time we'll cover a modern Who. Should I set the scene as to the world into which Doctor Who was born?
Sure.
British television, 1963, we had two TV channels. We had the BBC and we had ITV, which is a commercial channel. BBC doesn't run commercials. It's paid for out of public funds. So there was a limited amount of viewing available. Plus, television in those days wasn't on 24 hours a day. There were limited broadcasting hours. Everything was black and white, of course. And most British TV shows were shot as live, which means they were done in a TV studio with electronic cameras going through a vision mixer and recording onto videotape, if they were recorded at all. Some shows were just done live. More in 1963 were being recorded onto tape. This is very different to the situation in the US, where most primetime TV shows by 1963 were shot on film in Hollywood, and so they were made just like a movie is made. British TV was much more to the live TV model, shooting onto videotape. So into this world we get Doctor Who. It was shown on Saturday evenings, early evening, and the show was commissioned to very specifically fit between the sports programme, which finishes about 5 o'clock, and the evening entertainment shows, which sort of come on around 7 p.m. So somewhere in between those two, traditionally the BBC had been showing children's programmes or family-friendly programmes. And so the BBC were looking for something to go into this slot. It's the slot in the UK that we would call Saturday tea time. So the pitch that was put forward was this series, Doctor Who. And it was meant to be family viewing, so suitable for children, but not exclusively for children. And it was intended to be educational. So it would feature this time-travelling doctor who would go to different periods in history. And in the very first episode, he doesn't really do that, but in episode 2, he goes back to the Stone Age, and then in future episodes, he goes to other historical periods. Now, it became a little bit different from that as it evolved, and it became much more Monster of the Week. But that was the kind of the starting point with Doctor Who. I think the only other thing to say is that it wasn't specifically created by one person. So there was no Gene Roddenberry behind Doctor Who. There was no Irwin Allen. There was no Rod Serling. What you had was an executive, Sidney Newman, who also had a hand in the creation of the British series The Avengers, you know, with John Steed and Mrs. Peel, all of that. Mm-hmm. He co-created that. He was really the instigator of Doctor Who. And then there was a head of department at the BBC who was more the person who sort of worked out the story and the character. And then there was Anthony Coburn, who was the scriptwriter, who actually wrote the script. So it's really a collaborative thing, and it's not really clear who did what. So that's where we start with Doctor Who. The first episode went out on, I think it was the 23rd of November, 1963, which is the day after JFK was assassinated. And even though we're British and we keep a stiff upper lip, I think people were disturbed by what had just happened in the US. And so the BBC decided that they would repeat that first episode the following week because they thought people weren't able to absorb it properly. So episode 1 of Doctor Who was actually shown 2 weeks in a row. And in the second week, they followed it immediately with episode 2. So it's a very, very odd sort of arrangement there. But that's how we start with Doctor Who. And it's still going.
Well, there was a slight hiatus in the middle.
Well, there was, yeah. That's fair. And when it came back in the 2000s, really a very different show in terms of its production values, budget. In the 2000s, it's shot like a film is shot, and it's got very high quality special effects. It really rivals the best American science fiction shows, I think. Whereas in the early days, what Doctor Who had to rely on was decent storytelling, because it didn't have the look, because it looked very cheap. It didn't have the visual effects, because there was no budget. And frankly, most of it was rather static, because they were shooting it as live. probably like me, you saw the version of An Unearthly Child, which is from the Blu-ray, where you get to see some outtakes. Mm-hmm. And you may have noticed there was some very clumsy stuff going on with the set. When the two teachers come inside the TARDIS, one of the doors of the TARDIS swings shut and the other one swings open and and makes a very loud bang sound. And then they cut to another camera and you can't see the doors anymore, but you can hear the door banging again. And then the next time we see the doors, they're both closed. So there's some stagehands running about there trying to get this damn door back where it needs to be. And then in the retake, they seem to have fixed the problem because the teachers come through the door and then the doors just sort of quietly close all by themselves. So
yes, but in that same episode, there is a hand.
Oh yeah.
That appears in frame.
Yes. Yeah, and I saw a shadow as well. I can't remember quite when it was, but there was a shadow of somebody. It wasn't a shadow of an actor, but it was a shadow of somebody else cast onto the background, just a moving shadow. And I saw the microphone drop into shot a few times as well. So, but hey, this is how TV was done in those days. And I was going to say something about the camera work. The thing that surprised me the most was how fluid the camera work was. When they're walking around the junkyard, the camera is kind of following them. When they're in the TARDIS, the camera is sort of floating around between the characters to get close-ups and then pulling back to give two shots and three shots. So it's all very creative stuff. All of that is very difficult to orchestrate. And that's one of the things that I teach is live TV production and how you move cameras about without people knowing that you're moving them. And so it's all very extravagant what they're doing in this, but it's also asking for trouble. It's far easier to keep your cameras in a fixed position so that they don't risk bumping into each other, that kind of thing. But
yeah, the choreography between the actors is one thing, but when you have to have the actors, what few special effects you have, and all your camera and lighting and microphone, your grips, that's a huge dance.
Yeah, absolutely.
I know a very small amount about that from my experience at my church, where we do live production for, it's a large church. And so we have cameras that project onto the screen so that people are far away can still follow along and feel like they're connecting with people on stage. Yeah. And then during the pandemic, we started broadcasting our services on YouTube. Mm. And so there's a whole separate streaming setup with its own camera setup and mixers and trying to get all the right graphics to the right people and synchronize those. That's my job. I'm the director. Mm.
So with all that kit at your disposal, you could do your own Doctor Who fan series.
Oh, my goodness.
See, I've given you ideas there. When was your first encounter with Doctor Who, Connor?
My first encounter would have been, and I need to think about this for a sec, I believe 1986.
Okay.
So here in the United States, we have an analog to the BBC called PBS, the Public Broadcasting System. And every state has its own offshoot. And in Oregon, it's OPB, the Oregon Public Broadcasting System. Mm-hmm. And normally during the afternoons, they show children's programming. And then that moves into a news section between 4:30 and 6:30 or 7, and then usually something that was syndicated, and then you get into movies and documentaries and stuff. Mm-hmm. So I would come home from school, and one day I was flipping channels, and I came across this thing that was science fiction-y. Mm-hmm. And it was the Tom Baker Doctor Who.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I watched him for a couple of years at least. I think we were many years behind the most current episodes that were being shown in Britain.
Okay, so you were watching Tom Baker. We were probably on to the next Doctor by then, which would have been Peter Davison. Mm-hmm. And what did you think of it in terms of the look of it and the feel of it compared to American TV shows?
So in comparison, we had Battlestar Galactica, The Greatest American Hero, Star Trek, couple of Star Treks, the Star Wars movies. It was campy and funny, and yet it was still really kind of interesting and compelling about what he was doing. You know, he wrote this weird juxtaposition of being this kind of corny guy who was an alien, but also someone with really high morals and ethics about what should happen and what shouldn't happen and being responsible for things.
And having seen the very, very first episode of Doctor Who with William Hartnell called An Unearthly Child, do you recognise that early Doctor as being the same character as the Tom Baker character? I mean, it's not the same character because it's like a reincarnation, but did you sort of recognise the continuity between those two?
Just between the very, very first episode? No.
Right.
So, you know, the original William Hartnell Doctor in that first episode, he was, you know, kind of a crotchety old man.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, superior, condescending.
Yes.
harsh.
Yeah.
You know, he shocked one of his granddaughter's teachers at one point.
So clearly some sort of evolution had taken place between the early 60s and the episodes you were watching, which would have been from, I suppose, the late 70s, early 80s. Mm-hmm. Fascinating. Because, you see, I've grown up with Doctor Who. It's been there all the time through my life. Now, I don't remember the first time I ever saw it. I think I probably first ever saw it when the second Doctor was in place. So the first Doctor was William Hartnell. He did it for a few years and then left the show. And the decision was made that, hey, this is a fantasy character, essentially. Just because the actor's gone doesn't mean to say that the character has to go. So rather than try and find an actor who looked like Hartnell, they chose somebody who Hartnell could morph into. So we had the first of these. I don't know what the technical term is. All the Whovians are going to write in and say, oh, you got all the words wrong for this. But there's this sort of reincarnation process that happens where the Doctor essentially disappears and then comes back in a different guise, a new face, a new body, and usually a new set of clothes as well. And part of the ritual, because this has happened so many times now, they've changed the actor so many times, part of the ritual is the Doctor choosing his new set of clothes. And it's always quite fun to see that. But I think I first ever saw it with the second Doctor. I don't really have a clear enough memory of that, though. I mean, I've seen loads of Second Doctor stuff since, because lots of the tapes have survived, even though some are still missing. But I don't really have a direct memory of those. The first Doctor that I clearly remember is the third one, which was played by John Pertwee. And then he was succeeded by Tom Baker, which is the one that you first encountered. Mm-hmm. So, but between us, we've got quite a long history there with Doctor Who. I think you can imagine that anybody who was born in the 60s, as I was, in the UK, would have known Doctor Who as a constant presence. He went off the air, as you alluded to, for a period of time, and I don't have the dates in front of me, but there was perhaps a decade that Doctor Who was off the air, largely because the people in charge of the BBC at the time were rather hostile to the show, which they thought was corny and old-fashioned, and they were also hostile to science fiction in general. And then it took a number of years for people to say, hey, there might be some life in that old Doctor. And so various revival attempts were made. And when it was properly revived in the 2000s, it was a huge hit because it had been done so wonderfully well. And it's still with us today, despite many ups and downs, which we might talk about next episode when we talk about the more recent incarnations.
So how much of a cultural impact did Doctor Who have? So you mentioned you actually grew up with Doctor Who. Mm. Did people talk about it at school or, oh, yeah, you know, playing in the street?
Yeah.
You know, and did somebody play the Doctor?
Yeah.
And somebody was a Dalek or a Cyberman?
Yeah. Certainly in the John Pertwee times, I remember playing Doctor Who with the kids down the street. And you'd always get somebody who was the sort of the alpha male in the group would always be We always bag the the role of the Doctor, and then you'd get lumbered with something like the Brigadier, or if you were really unlucky, a bit later on, I'm sure some kid would get lumbered with the part of K-9.
Oh, yeah.
It was one of my favourite characters, actually. I quite like K-9. But yeah, it absolutely is a cultural phenomenon. I think the Wikipedia page says that as well. In the UK, Doctor Who is a cultural phenomenon. There are so many ways in which Doctor Who infiltrated our lives. There was a huge amount of merchandising. There were obviously things like books, and I suppose lunchboxes and those kind of things that we always associate with science fiction merchandising. Mm-hmm. They hugely promoted the Daleks, which for anyone who doesn't know what a Dalek is, it's the Daleks are really the Nazis of the Doctor Who universe, and they're basically robots, but inside them is an organic life form. And the Daleks appeared in the second story of Doctor Who, so they were there almost from the very beginning. But the marketing that went with the Daleks was huge. You could buy toys in all sizes. You could probably buy a life-size one. I don't know if I ever saw one of those. I do know that you could buy a kind of a plastic thing that you put over your child, and supposedly it made them look like a Dalek, but it didn't. It just made them look as if they're wearing a poncho or something. And there were a couple of films made in the 60s based on the TV series, but focused largely on the Daleks. And those starred Peter Cushing as the Doctor. And it's just gone on and on. The fact that it's been around for so very long means that everybody knows Doctor Who. Even if they don't watch it, they know what it is. And whenever there's a change of Doctor, to this day, it becomes a huge media talking point. And they for the forthcoming change in Doctor, they kind of threw everyone for a loop by making us think that the new actor playing the Doctor was going to be Shuti Gatwa. And he will be. He is playing the Doctor, but not straight away. So Jodie Whittaker changes. This has already been broadcast. She changed, and at the end of the episode where she changed, she didn't turn up as Shuti Gatwa. She turned up as David Tennant, who had been the Doctor about four Doctors prior to her. So we've suddenly got this, oh my god, Tennant is back. And that was like a big shock when that happened. And it turns out that we've got three episodes coming up with David Tennant in the lead role, and then he will transform into the next actor along the line. I can't think of any other show that has done anything like this. There have been shows where the lead actor has been replaced, either by taking out the character and putting in a new character, or by just changing the actor and pretending they're the same as they were before. But I can't think of any other show where the lead character remains in place, but with a different actor and a different look. I really can't think of anything close to it. So it's got to be unique on those grounds.
Yeah. It makes me wonder, of course, was that the original plan? Or did they find they had something very popular that people enjoyed and that they enjoyed doing? And so when the actor wanted to leave, they would say, okay, how are we going to handle this? Okay, he's a Time Lord. Time Lords are aliens. Aliens can, and actually the word is regenerate.
Hooray, thank you, yes.
Yes, aliens can regenerate after they die due to illness or age or infirmity or wounds.
Yeah.
And so then you just bring on another one and keep going until you run that guy out.
Yeah, yeah. I think it is that they never intended that this would happen. It was just people being really quite creative when faced with the problem of what do you do when your lead actor leaves. And I think they did an amazingly clever thing. It does mean that Doctor Who essentially is fantasy rather than science fiction, because although they can wave their hands and say, oh, his molecules are being redistributed and blah, 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 no, it's really just magic. But it works really well. And yes. It adds a dimension to it, and it essentially makes the series infinitely regeneratable in itself. You know, quite apart from the character regenerating, it allows the show to reinvent itself every time, because along with the Doctor, you usually get companions. So Doctor Who isn't usually a solo traveller. He usually has somebody with him. And in the very first episode, An Unearthly Child, that's what the unearthly child is. It is the Doctor's companion. And in this case, it's his granddaughter. Now, as far as I know, that's the only relative of the Doctor who has been a companion. I could be wrong there, but it's something that was there in the beginning, that the Doctor had a granddaughter, in order to kind of soften him, I think, and make him a bit more relatable. And they didn't... I think the original suggestion was that he travels with a young girl, and people thought, no, that would sound a bit weird if you had an old man travelling with a young girl. Let's make her the granddaughter, and therefore it's okay. But after that, I think they felt they didn't need to do that anymore, and so he had various companions of different ages, ethnicity, mm-hmm. Some of them were aliens, some of them were from Earth, some of them were from the future, some were from the past. So you could have any kind of companion that you wanted, essentially. And I think that the history of Doctor Who, people talk about having their Doctor. They say, oh, my Doctor was Tom Baker, or my Doctor was Sylvester McCoy. But I think often people overlook the companions. I think sometimes the companions are what make Doctor Who as a show, or at least the relationship between the Doctor and the companion. And some of the companions have been snarky and critical of the Doctor. Some of them have essentially been in love with the Doctor. So again, you get a huge variety over time, and it all adds to the mix, you know, and allows the show to have enormous flexibility in what it does. Going back to that first Doctor, shall we sort of just review it as an episode?
Yes. So, yeah, it actually opens up with a young girl in school and her teachers who are talking about her, because she's not quite like everyone else. She doesn't fit in, but she seems to have immense knowledge about science and mathematics.
Yeah.
And I remember, in fact, one line where she's talking about trying to solve something similar to the Pythagorean theorem. And she says, well, you can't possibly do that without, you know, D and E. Mm-hmm. And so she's talking about other dimensions.
Yes.
which seems odd, because usually knowledge builds on itself. And so I didn't understand why she wouldn't know the basic two-dimensional and three-dimensional theorems.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
The higher order theorems. But
yeah.
the point is to show that she is different and knows more than we do.
Yeah.
And the teachers are so concerned about her that they follow her home one day, which is to a junkyard, and find out that she lives inside of a standard British blue police mailbox.
It's not a mailbox. It's more of a phone box, really.
But phone box.
Yeah.
And they follow her in, and inside it is huge. Much larger than the 3 feet by 3 feet it appears to be on the outside.
Yeah.
And that's because they've stepped into the TARDIS.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've talked about the Doctor and his companions, but we hadn't talked about the TARDIS yet. So the TARDIS is an acronym. It stands for Time and Relative Dimensions in Space. It's way bigger on the inside than on the outside. And it travels through time and space.
Hmm.
It is the Doctor... Yeah, the Doctor's ship.
And in fact, he uses that word, doesn't he? And one of the teachers picks him up on it and says, ship. And he says, oh, just using your terminology for any vehicle that doesn't travel on wheels. Which is quite nice. I'd honestly never thought about why we call a spaceship a ship before. You know, obviously, it's by analogy with a real ship. But why did we call them spaceships? Why didn't we call them space cars?
Or space planes.
Indeed, yeah. But the Doctor has the answer there, which is great. The police box is one of those quirks of Doctor Who, which has stayed with it for most of the 60 years. There was a period when the John Pertwee Doctor was in place that the TARDIS kind of went away. I don't know the exact reasoning for that, but the Doctor became very earthbound during the John Pertwee era, and he travelled around in a vintage car rather than in a TARDIS. And I'm sure there was some in-universe explanation for why the TARDIS wasn't available to him. But it was brought back, and it's remained part of the sort of standard iconography of Doctor Who. And today, well, there's been a couple of generations of kids who've grown up just knowing that as a vehicle that Doctor Who travels in, or the Doctor travels in. But back in 1963, there were police boxes. I wouldn't say on every street corner, that would be exaggerating it, but there were police boxes in many towns throughout the UK. I don't think I've ever seen one in the flesh, and I think today there are probably only about two or three left in the entire country. You'll see some in museums, but actually being used for their original purpose of a police box, they really were being phased out in the early 60s. And that's really why this police box is in the junkyard. It's natural. But one of the teachers says, what's this doing in a junkyard? It should be on the street. But I think really in 1963, they were trashing them. And so a junkyard is really quite a natural place to see one of those police boxes back in the day. Nowadays, you wouldn't see one. If one suddenly appeared in the street outside your house tomorrow, you would know that the Doctor had arrived, because there's no, literally no other use for those boxes. And what they were, apparently, is kind of like a mini police station. It's somewhere for a policeman on the beat. And it was policemen in those days. It didn't really have police women on the beat in the UK. Policemen on the beat, if they needed to, I don't know, fill in a form or something, they could go to the police box, and there'd be a little desk in there, and there'd be some pens and some paper and some forms, and there was a telephone, so they could call to the station, because they didn't have walkie-talkies in those days or mobile phones. So that's what they were for, but they were also available for the public. So if you wanted to contact the police and you didn't have a phone in your house, you could go to the nearest police box and make a call, and probably do it for free, but I don't know. The existence of the TARDIS itself is building on a piece of obsolescent technology. And I'm trying to think of what the analogy would be today. If you were to create a series today and have the main character travel around in an obsolescent piece of technology, I can't really think what that would be.
It's almost like Superman's phone booth for changing in.
Yeah, yeah. It's a bit like somebody traveling in a fax machine.
Oh, yeah.
Because those of us of a certain age know what a fax machine is. But how many of us have used one in the last 10 years?
I had not known that they were obsoleting those as you were growing up, because I was going to ask you, you know, did people run up to the mailbox and to the police box and open it up to make sure that it was, you know, not the TARDIS? And I'm the police would be like, hey, we're not Gallifreyans. Please stop going into our police boxes, because it's not okay. Well, and again, because they were budget limited, they were remarkably creative. The Doctor has a tool called the sonic screwdriver.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't go back and check to see when that was introduced, but essentially he can point it and then make anything happen that he needs to have happen to stop people, fix things, control things. They're kind of geniuses in the whole idea of hand wavium.
Absolutely. Yeah, it is literally a magic wand. Well, no, it's not literally a magic wand. It is figuratively a magic wand. But you know what they say? Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic.
That's right.
So. On the matter of whether the character is called Doctor Who or not, I know Whovians will correct me if I call the character Doctor Who. If I say, oh, Tom Baker is playing Doctor Who, they'll say, no, he's not Doctor Who, he's the Doctor. And the title of the show is Doctor Who, is to reflect the fact that people don't really know who he is. He's mysterious, so he's the Doctor. But the Doctor, Doctor Who? It's kind of like a question. Most of my life, I've known this, and I usually correct myself if I refer to William Hartnell as playing Doctor Who. He's playing the Doctor. But I would like every Whovian to acknowledge that in the very first episode of Doctor Who, if you look at the end credits, it says, Doctor Who, William Hartnell. It doesn't say the Doctor. It says Doctor Who. So it was the name of the character, on one level at least.
Yeah. I did a little reading on mythology, and it turns out that at one point they decided he had a name, but no Earthling could pronounce it. And so he just went by the Doctor. And then some people said, well, actually, his name translated means the Doctor.
Ah.
So he would be like, you know, the Butcher, the Baker, the Doctor. Yeah. And that's just who they were. You know, they were the Smiths. But the nice thing about Doctor Who is it has a 60-year history, and dozens of people have played him and run it and written for it. Mm-hmm. And so they kind of just invent things when they want it. And there's this nice, interesting meandering of mythology and showmanship. And
it sort of warps to reflect the character of the performer. Mm-hmm. So you do get a distinct difference. Okay, it's written, so we're really seeing the differences between the writers as well. But there's no doubt that Tom Baker brings a different physical presence to the character than William Hartnell does. And David Tennant brings a very different physical presence to Jodie Whittaker. So the actor brings an awful lot. And then after a while, of course, writers begin writing the character to suit the actor. So you get a rather complex interplay of the two. But I found it, based on what you see in An Unearthly Child, in a way I found it unlikely that Doctor Who would be as long-lived as it has been, because the character is not really very likeable.
No.
They soften it by giving him the companion in the granddaughter, but she's a bit weird, as reflected in the title, An Unearthly Child. So it's difficult to relate to her. So who do we relate mostly to in that first episode? It's probably the teachers, because they're the sort of, in air quotes, they're the normal people in the story.
Yeah, it's kind of like the American medical drama House.
Yeah.
With Hugh Laurie. And there's probably other examples of that as well, but I think that's part of his evolution. You know, I think he went from being like the conductor for this show to being the main character of the show, who still kept a companion so that you could relate to him and explore his character in ways that a standalone character couldn't really have done very well.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's probably true. Incidentally, the first actor, William Hartnell, was mostly known for playing, well, I suppose what people call heavies. So he would tend to play villainous characters in British films, and also in comedies as well. And he was in a sitcom, I think, immediately before he was in Doctor Who. So in the public mind, if they recognised him at all, and I think most people watching would have recognised him because he was a very familiar character actor, they would have known him as somebody with a kind of a stern outlook, but who could also do humour. But there's no real humour in this first episode, I don't think.
No. The next episode happened to be right on the same website, so I watched it next.
Hmm.
And, you know, he's very quickly taken out of commission, and the plot is carried by the cavemen, because they go into the past. So the Doctor has been discovered, and so is his granddaughter, and to protect themselves, they have to get rid of these two teachers, and so he takes them to the past where he's going to abandon them. Mm-hmm. And it turns out they land in a situation with Neolithic humans who are just learning to make fire.
Right.
And the current leader's father had been the fire maker for the tribe, but he never taught his son.
Uh-huh.
And so the father passes away. The son is supposed to inherit, but he doesn't know how to make fire. And then he's challenged by a stranger. And so even though it's people wearing wigs and furs and they're talking standard English, which we would totally do in the 1960s, yeah, and most other times, there's this incredibly rich drama going on.
Uh-huh.
I think it holds, I think the storyline holds up even today, because you could have those things happen. Mm. On one of the streaming shows, there's Succession, where the father is dying and he has to choose one of his children to succeed him. And it's all about their competition to please dad and dad being unhappy. And
yeah, it's interesting that you found that there was something there that was good, because I wasn't expecting that there would be. I do know that the next serial, so once this caveman one is out of the way, they then move on to the first Dalek story. And that's apparently is where Doctor Who really took off in the public consciousness, because the Daleks scared the hell out of people.
Because it has been on so long. And the thing about the Doctor is he travels through time and space.
Yeah.
It is possible for future Doctors to meet old Doctors.
Oh, yes.
So sometimes, you know, previous actors will reprise their roles and the two Doctors will get together and they will have a conflict or there's something they'll do together.
Yeah.
Which I thought was a fascinating idea. Mm. They've developed their own mythology and this 60-year-long story, and they keep pulling from it and making forward and backward references. And
there are probably all sorts of contradictions in there over a 60-year history. There's bound to be things that contradict what have gone before. But it doesn't seem to get into a tangle in the same way that modern Star Trek does. With Star Trek, they quite often say, oh, we're doing a prequel now. And they set the thing 10 years before the era that we're familiar with. And then they start doing things that contradict the possibility of it really being 10 years before. And I would say, why did you do that? Why did you say it was a prequel? Why not set it in the future? And then you can do whatever you like. But Doctor Who keeps going backwards and forwards in time, crisscrossing. And as I say, it probably does contradict itself, but it doesn't seem to matter. It hasn't built a canon in quite the same way, for me anyway. Maybe Whovians feel differently, but I think there's something worthy of study there. So if there's anyone out there who wants to do a PhD in Doctor Who, I think I've got a couple of topics you could use.
Yeah, maybe it's a lack of rigidity in the canon because of the core concept of time travel.
Maybe, yeah. Wibbly-wobbly time.
Well, this idea, yeah. It could be changed by him or someone else or someone in the future or one of his enemies in the current universe. Or the other thing it could be is a flexibility in the fandom.
Yes.
You know, I don't know if Doctor Who fans have the same argument about who's the best captain of the Enterprise. You know, who's the best Doctor? Who was the best companion?
Yeah.
I don't know if those things exist or not.
Hmm. Nor do I. I do hope we get some Whovians commenting on this. And not in a critical way, but helping us with this, with our understanding of this phenomenon.
In a way, that's our podcast, right? Is encouraging others to learn about science fiction. And, you know, we know quite a bit about science fiction, although not as much as, you know, the most foremost scholars or the forward fans. But I've enjoyed the learning part of this an awful lot.
Yeah, me too.
There was something I wanted to ask you, and that is, do you consider yourself a Doctor Who fan, and do you like it and watch it?
I generally do watch it, but during the most recent incarnation of the Doctor, I stopped watching it because the writing became quite terrible, in my view. So I've missed most of the Jodie Whittaker era. I saw the first season that she was in, and I think she's a fantastic actor, and I think the performance she gives is superb. But I think the episodes are just badly written. And I'm hoping that will be reversed with the new series that's coming up. But yeah, I've watched all of the modern Whos, with the exception of the last year or so of Jodie Whittaker. And before that, I dipped in and out. John Pertwee era, I remember distinctly, and I think I watched all of those when they first went out. I watched about half of Tom Baker, and then I lost interest. And then I stayed away from Doctor Who for many years, because to me it was a bit childish. Once you get to the Sylvester McCoy era and the Colin Baker era, it just seemed a bit childish to me. And I would dip into it every now and again. But so, no, I don't consider myself a fan. I don't have a fanish devotion to it. But I am quite well versed in it, let's say.
My whole experience with Doctor Who was watching syndicated versions on Oregon Public Broadcasting. And then once it wasn't available, you couldn't watch it back then.
Right. Yeah.
And then I've never really dipped into the modern era, although having watched one recently, I'm curious about, you know, how it developed and how the character has changed and what the mythology is like.
Mm, yeah. I think if you've never really watched the modern ones, I think it's a good idea to go back to the beginning of the modern era and watch the first season at least of that. And I think you'll be impressed. And I think it's sustained itself remarkably well over the years through all the changes that it's gone through. Doctor Who won Hugo Awards for about 5 or 6 years in a row, but that hasn't happened for about a decade now. And I think that sort of reflects the gradual decline in quality, or shall we say the gradual decline in originality of the series. It's probably a fairer way of putting it.
Yeah.
So, shall we do a past, present and future?
Yes.
I've just got one past item. On my script here on my tablet, I wrote one and two. I clearly was going to put in a second one, but I couldn't think of a second one. So I've just got one past item. This is something that the science fiction writer Robert J. Sawyer posted on Facebook. He said something like, H.G. Wells had an unequalled and unsurpassed run of 4 consecutive years of putting out great science fiction novels. So he points out that 1895, The Time Machine, 1896, The Island of Dr. Moreau, 1897, The Invisible Man, 1898, The War of the Worlds. 4 years in a row, 4 really seminal science fiction works, really 4 works that define the field of science fiction. And Robert Sawyer says nobody else can match that. Now, of course, that's a challenge. So you start thinking, oh, but what about? And then you go and look it up and you think, oh, no, Sawyer was right all along. So I thought, oh, what about Heinlein? So I went and looked up Heinlein, and there are some gaps. And this is what you often find, is that somebody might have written 4 great books in a row, but they're not published in consecutive years. Or they might have written 4 great books in 4 consecutive years, but one of the books isn't a novel, it's a collection. You see what I mean? I've not been able to find anyone who comes close to Wells. So if anyone out there thinks of somebody, let us know.
Didn't Nnedi Okorafor write 3 Hugo, at least nominated, if not winning, novels in a row on consecutive
possibly,
years?
Possibly. I'd have to look into it. But,
but
that
again, that's
sounds
not 4.
Right. No, that's right. 3 is not 4.
Well, you know, the research project trying to find the reviews for Little Fuzzy back in the 60s was fun. Mm. This might be another interesting project.
There you go. Another challenge for you.
Yeah. So we're looking at, you know, at least award nominated works.
Probably. I mean, it doesn't have to be that, because, of course, H.G. Wells never won a Hugo or a Nebula because they didn't exist. So,
yes.
You know, we don't have to hold it just to award winning. But obviously, that's a very good indicator. And it gives you a kind of an objective measure, doesn't it? If you can say, oh, yeah, but all 4 of these won a Hugo, or all 4 of these won a Nebula. I mean, my first thought is, what about Jules Verne? So I looked it up, and no, he doesn't have 4 consecutive years of great science fiction novels. He just doesn't. They're spread out, and they're mixed in with some things which are not, either they're not science fiction, or they're not great. What about present items?
I am a Babylon 5 fan. I've watched the series 3 times through. I like it every time. It's withstood the test of time because I've watched it literally in 3 different decades, and I still think the special effects hold up pretty well. The writing is good. The plot is compelling. I identify with the characters. This month, in fact, last week, a DVD was issued of a story from the Babylon 5 time. Now, if you follow the Babylon 5, you know that they're talking about rebooting it. Yeah. And between the writer's strike and the actor's strike, that's all kind of on hold. But this was in production, you know, probably years before. And Straczynski has made up a new story about John Sheridan from back in the day. Mm-hmm. So if you're eager for new content from that era, it's available and you can go get it.
Terrific. It's good how you turn that around, because what you were saying was largely about the past. And I thought, this isn't the present. But then you turned it around and made it relevant. I've just got one present item, a bit of self-promotion, of course. The new Ray Bradbury Review, which is the journal of the Ray Bradbury Center in Indianapolis, is very soon to be published. In fact, by the time this episode of the podcast goes out, it may already have been published. It's issue number 7, because there have been 6 previous issues. But this one is going to be online and free for anyone to read. So look out for that. You can Google it. And the website's already there. And the reason it's self-promotion is because I'm the editor.
Move on to the future?
Yes. What have you got?
Well, I understand that in 2024, the World Science Fiction Convention is going to be about 4 hours north of where you live.
Really? Where's it going to be?
Glasgow, Scotland.
Oh, okay. Ah.
So, for those that don't know, my friend Seth, who I podcast with, he received a Hugo nomination this year.
Yes.
For his other podcast, Hugo's There.
Yeah.
And circumstances dictate he can't go to China. And so we started talking about where he could go. And one of the places, like, he'd go to Glasgow next year.
Yeah.
And you and I have been doing this remotely for a number of years. But what if we planned an in-person recording at the World Science Fiction Convention in 2024?
Yes. We should indeed consider that. Yes. I think that's a great idea.
Okay. Cool.
Add that to the list.
Yeah. It's a bit longer of a commute for me than you.
Yeah.
Which brings me up to potentially another future idea.
Mm-hmm.
Seattle, Washington is going to bid for the 2025 World Science Fiction Convention.
And that's about 4 hours from you, is it?
That's about 4 hours north of me.
So there's our fallback, you see. If Glasgow falls through, Seattle can be our savior.
Yes, yeah.
You said that Seth won't be able to go to China. There's a science fictional response to that, which is from Star Trek 6. I think it was Spock who says only Nixon could go to China.
Only Nixon.
Do you remember that? Do you remember that line?
No, I don't.
It's really Nicholas Meyer who wrote the script, just trying to be witty. But it's a sort of a very out of context quote for Spock.
Yeah.
Only Nixon could go to China. Future items. Oh, yeah. Speaking of Doctor Who, Doctor Who is returning in November of 2023 for a series of specials that tie in with the 60th anniversary of the show. And as I think I mentioned before, somewhat surprisingly, David Tennant is back as the Doctor for these specials. Here's the curious bit. According to the internet, which knows everything, according to the internet, David Tennant isn't coming back as the 10th Doctor, which is what he was before. He's actually playing the 14th Doctor. So the implication is that this is a different character, a different incarnation. Whether that is true or not, I do not know. But it will be interesting to see.
There are so many internet rumors.
Yeah.
I've been following the ones for the new upcoming Star Wars series that comes out next Tuesday night at midnight. Ahsoka, which is about a character that was created for the Clone Wars and by Dave Filoni. And she finally gets her own live-action Disney Plus Star Wars series.
Mm.
And people are dissecting trailers and inferring things and making wild claims and guesses. And yeah. I've just gotten to the point where I want to watch it and try to enjoy it as it is versus try to anticipate what it's going to be.
Hear, hear. Any more future items from you?
No.
Okay, shall we wrap it up for today?
Let's.
So thanks for listening, folks. We're Phil Nichols and Colin Kusky. Our theme tune is from purpleplanet.com. Check out our show notes at 101sf.blogspot.com, where you can also leave us a comment, or even drop a couple of quid in our tip jar. And don't forget to give us a nice 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. See you next time for some more Doctor Who.